In times of stress, anxiety, and isolation, finding effective strategies to understand our emotions and how we relate to the world at large often brings comfort. Mindfulness, meditation, and compassion have long been championed as helpful strategies. But how do they impact our well-being, if at all? I'm Katerina Badzaiki, and in this week's Infinitely Curious program of ERT and the Voice of Greece, we will explore the power of meditation and how it nourishes a healthy body and mind.
Thank you.
Alan Wilson Watts was an English writer, speaker, and self-styled philosophical entertainer known for interpreting and popularizing Japanese, Chinese, and Indian traditions of Buddhist, Taoist, and Hindu philosophy for a Western audience back in the 1950s and 60s. His essential message and the whole point and joy of human life, as he shared in the preface to his autobiography In My Own Way, was to integrate the spiritual with the material. He believed that this could only be done by carving your own way, by accepting your own karma, and by following your own weird. Here is how he interprets meditation by calling it an art itself.
The art of meditation is a way of getting into touch with reality. And the reason for it is that most civilized people are out of touch with reality because they confuse the world as it is with the world as they think about it and talk about it and describe it. For on the one hand, there is the real world, and on the other, a whole system of symbols about that world which we have in our minds. These are very, very useful symbols. All civilization depends on them. But like all good things, they have their disadvantages. And the principal disadvantage of symbols is that we confuse them with reality, just as we confuse money with actual wealth. And our names about ourselves, our ideas of ourselves, our images of ourselves with ourselves. Now, of course, reality, from a philosopher's point of view, is a dangerous word. A philosopher will ask me, what do I mean by reality? Am I talking about the physical world of nature? Or am I talking about a spiritual world, or what? And to that I have a very simple answer. When we talk about the material world, that is actually a philosophical concept. So in the same way, if I say that reality is spiritual, that's also a philosophical concept. And reality itself is not a concept. Reality is... and we won't give it a name. Now, it's amazing what doesn't exist in the real world. For example, in the real world, there aren't any things, nor are there any events. That doesn't mean to say that the real world is a perfectly featureless blank. It means that it is a marvelous system of wiggles in which we descry things and events in the same way as we would project images on a Rorschach blot or pick out particular groups of stars in the sky and call them constellations, as if they were separate groups of stars. Well, they're groups of stars in the mind's eye in our system of concepts. They are not out there as constellations already grouped in the sky. So in the same way, the difference between myself and all the rest of the universe is nothing more than an idea. It is not a real difference. And meditation is the way in which we come to feel our basic inseparability from the whole universe. And what that requires is that we shut up. That is to say, that we become interiorly silent and cease from the interminable chatter that goes on inside our skulls. Because you see, most of us think compulsively all the time. That is to say, we talk to ourselves. I remember when I was a boy, we had a common saying, talking to yourself is the first sign of madness. Now, obviously, If I talk all the time, I don't hear what anyone else has to say. And so in exactly the same way, if I think all the time, that is to say, if I talk to myself all the time, I don't have anything to think about except thoughts. And therefore, I'm living entirely in the world of symbols, and I'm never in relationship with reality. All right, now that's the first basic reason for meditation. But there is another sense, and this is going to be a little bit more difficult to understand, why we could say that meditation doesn't have a reason or doesn't have a purpose. And in this respect, it's unlike almost all other things that we do, except perhaps making music and dancing. Because when we make music, we don't do it in order to reach a certain point, such as the end of the composition. If that were the purpose of music, to get to the end of the piece, then obviously the fastest players would be the best. And so likewise, when we are dancing, we are not aiming to arrive at a particular place on the floor, as we would be if we were taking a journey. When we dance, the journey itself is the point. When we play music, the playing itself is the point. And exactly the same thing is true in meditation. Meditation is the discovery that the point of life is always arrived at in the immediate moment. And therefore, if you meditate for an ulterior motive, that is to say, to improve your mind, to improve your character, to be more efficient in life, you've got your eye on the future and you are not meditating. Because the future is a concept. It doesn't exist. As the proverb says, tomorrow never comes. There is no such thing as tomorrow. There never will be. Because time is always now. And that's one of the things we discover when we stop talking to ourselves and stop thinking, we find there is only a present, only an eternal now. So it's funny then, isn't it, that one meditates for no reason at all, except we could say for the enjoyment of it. And here I would interpose the essential principle that meditation is supposed to be fun. It's not something you do as a grim duty. The trouble with religion as we know it is that it is so mixed up with grim duties. We do it because it's good for you. It's a kind of self-punishment. Well, meditation, when correctly done, has nothing to do with all that. It's a kind of digging the present. It's a kind of grooving with the eternal now. And brings us into a state of peace, where we can understand that the point of life, the place where it's at, is simply here and now. Well, now, in the art of meditation, there are various props, supports. One thing that we are going to use as a means of stilling chatter in the mind is pure sound. And for that reason, it's useful to have a gong. This is a Japanese Buddhist gong made of bronze and shaped like a bowl. If you don't have one of these, you can get the rounded end of an oxygen tank. Have a machinist saw it off roughly into the shape of a bowl and use that. Or you can use your own voice, chanting. Another prop in meditation is the use of incense. And that is because the sense of smell is our repressed sense. And because it's our repressed sense, it has a very powerful influence on us. And therefore, we associate certain smells with certain states of mind. And so the smell of incense is associated with peace and contemplation. And so it's advantageous to burn incense in meditation. The other prop is a string of beads. And these beads are used in meditation for an unconscious method of timing yourself. Instead of looking at a watch, you move a bead each time you breathe in and out, so that at a certain rate, you see, there are always 108 beads on a rosary. And when you get to slow breathing, halfway around the rosary is about 40 minutes. And that is the usual length of time for which one sits in meditation, because otherwise you get uncomfortable and you get stiff legs and problems of that kind. Now then, the other thing, first of all, that we have to go into is, how does one sit in meditation? You can sit any way you want. You can sit in a chair, or you can sit like I'm sitting, which is the Japanese way of sitting, or you can sit in the lotus posture, which is more difficult, which is cross-legged with the feet on the thighs, soles upwards. And the younger you start that in life, the easier you'll find it to do. Or you can just sit cross-legged on a raised cushion above the floor. Now the point of this is that if you keep your back erect, I don't mean stiff like this, nor slumped like this, but just easily erect, you are centered and easily balanced, and you have a feeling of being thoroughly rooted to the ground. And that sort of physical stability is very important for the avoidance of distraction and generally feeling settled. Here and now, je suis, je reste, as the French say. I'm here and I'm going to stay. Well now, the easiest way to get into the meditative state is to begin by listening. If you simply close your eyes and allow yourself to hear all the sounds that are going on around you, just listen to the general hum and buzz of the world as if you were listening to music. Don't try to identify the sounds you're hearing. Don't put names on them. Simply allow them to play with your eardrums. And let them go. In other words, you could put it, let your ears hear whatever they want to hear. Don't judge the sounds. There are no, as it were, proper sounds or improper sounds, and it doesn't matter if somebody coughs or sneezes or drops something. It's all just sound. And if I am talking to you right now and you're doing this, I want you to listen to the sound of my voice just as if it were noise. Don't try to make any sense out of what I'm saying, because your brain will take care of that automatically. You don't have to try to understand anything. Just listen to the sound. As you pursue that experiment, you will very naturally find that you can't help naming sounds, identifying them, that you will go on thinking, that is to say, talking to yourself inside your head automatically. But it's important that you don't try to repress those thoughts by forcing them out of your mind, because that will have precisely the same effect as if you were trying to smooth rough water with a flat iron. You're just going to disturb it all the more. What you do is this. As you hear sounds coming up in your head, thoughts, you simply listen to them as part of the general noise going on, just as you would be listening to the sound of my voice, or just as you would be listening to cars going by or to birds chattering outside the window. So look at your own thoughts as just noises. And soon you will find that the so-called outside world and the so-called inside world come together. They are a happening. Your thoughts are a happening, just like the sounds going on outside. And everything is simply a happening, and all you're doing is watching it. Now, in this process, another thing that is happening that is very important is that you're breathing. And as you start meditation, you allow your breath to run just as it wills. In other words, don't do at first any breathing exercise, but just watch your breath breathing the way it wants to breathe. And notice a curious thing about this. You say in the ordinary way, I breathe, because you feel that breathing is something that you are doing voluntarily, just in the same way as you might be walking or talking. But you will also notice that when you are not thinking about breathing, your breathing goes on just the same. So the curious thing about breath is that it can be looked at both as a voluntary and an involuntary action. You can feel on the one hand, I am doing it, and on the other hand, it is happening to me. And that is why breathing is a most important part of meditation, because it is going to show you, as you become aware of your breath, that the hard and fast division that we make between what we do on the one hand and what happens to us on the other is arbitrary. So that as you watch your breathing, you will become aware that both the voluntary and the involuntary aspects of your experience are all one happening. Now, that may at first seem a little scary, because you may think, well, am I just the puppet of a happening, the mere passive witness of something that's going on completely beyond my control? Or on the other hand, am I really doing everything that's going along? Well, if I were, I should be God. And that would be very embarrassing, because I would be in charge of everything. That would be a terribly responsible position. The truth of the matter, as you will see it, is that both things are true. You can see it that everything is happening to you, and on the other hand, you're doing everything. For example, it's your eyes that are turning the sun into light. It's the nerve ends in your skin that are turning electric vibrations in the air into heat and temperature. It's your eardrums that are turning vibrations in the air into sound, and in that way, you are creating the world. But when we are not talking about it, when we are not philosophizing about it, then there is just this happening, and we won't give it a name. Now then, when you breathe for a while, just letting it happen, and not forcing it in any way, you will discover a curious thing, that without making any effort, you can breathe more and more deeply. In other words, supposing you simply are breathing out, and breathing out is important because it's the breath of relaxation, as when we say, whew, and heave a sigh of relief. So when you are breathing out, you get the sensation that your breath is falling out. Dropping, dropping, dropping out, with the same sort of feeling you have as if you were settling down into an extremely comfortable bed. And you just get as heavy as possible and let yourself go. And you let your breath go out in just that way. And when it's thoroughly comfortably out and it feels like coming back again, you don't pull it back in, you let it fall back in. Letting your lungs expand, expand, expand until they feel very comfortably full. And you wait a moment and let it stay there. And then once again, you let it fall out. And so in this way, you will discover that your breath gets quite naturally easier and easier and slower and more powerful. So that with these various aids, listening to sound, listening to your own interior feelings and thoughts, just as if they were something going on, not something you're doing, but just happenings, and watching your breath as a happening that is neither voluntary nor involuntary, you are simply aware of these basic sensations, then you begin to be in the state of meditation. But don't hurry anything. Don't worry about the future. Don't worry about what progress you're making. Just be entirely content to be aware of what is.
Peace within me.
But Alan Watts was not the only one to introduce meditation to the Western world. The pioneer in this endeavor was Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, also known as Osho. Bhagwan was an Indian spiritual leader who preached an eclectic doctrine of Eastern mysticism, individual devotion, and sexual freedom, and went as far as building a spiritual commune at the Central Oregon in the US in the early 1980s in order to teach the Western world the beauty and power of spirituality and meditation. His followers and residents of this community, also known as the Rajneeshis, were instructed to start their day with an hour-long dynamic meditation, which would be divided into five parts. This would include exhaling in a chaotic manner for 10 minutes, following which there would be total catharsis. This is where they were asked to release feelings and emotions by singing, shouting, dancing, kicking, and laughing. Following this, they would have to jump up and down, and then stay frozen for several minutes to understand the depth of their emotions until the reality of their surroundings came back into focus. Then they would break into dance and end the meditation in pure silence. Osho was one of the few to speak of the ultimate goal of meditation as the pursuit of no mind for achieving sheer happiness and joy.
You say, when I hear you say meditation is witnessing, I feel I understand. But when you talk about no mind, it doesn't sound easy at all. How it can sound easy? Because it is your future possibility. Meditation you have started. It may be in the beginning stages, but you have a certain experience of it that makes you understand me. But if you can understand meditation, don't be worried at all. Meditation surely leads to no mind, just as every river moves towards the ocean without any maps, without any guides. Every river, without exception, finally reaches to the ocean. Every meditation, without exception, finally reaches to the state of no mind. But naturally, when the Ganges is in the Himalayas, wandering into the mountains and in the valleys, has no idea what the ocean is. Cannot conceive the existence of ocean, but it is moving towards the ocean. Because the water has the intrinsic capacity of always finding the lowest place. And the oceans are the lowest place. So the rivers are born on the peaks of the Himalayas and start moving immediately towards lower spaces. And finally they are bound to find the ocean. Just the rivers is the process of meditation. It moves upwards to higher peaks. And the ultimate peak is no mind. No mind is a simple word, but it exactly means enlightenment, liberation, freedom from all bondage. Experience of deathlessness and immortality. Those are big words, and I don't want you to be frightened. So I use a simple word, no mind. You know the mind. You can conceive a state when this mind will be non-functioning. Once this mind is non-functioning, you become part of the mind of the cosmos, the universal mind. When you are part of the universal mind, your individual mind functions as a beautiful servant. It has recognized the master, and it brings news from the universal mind to those who are still chained by the individual mind. When I'm speaking to you, it is in fact the universe using me. My words are not my words. They belong to the universal truth. That is their power. That is their charisma. That is their magic.
Yidu Krishnamurti was an Indian philosopher, speaker and writer. In his early life, he was raised to be the new world teacher, an advanced spiritual position in the theosophical tradition, but later rejected this mantle and distanced himself from the related movement. Krishnamurti's thoughts on meditation and mindfulness were distinct from other traditional practices. He believed that one should observe the mind without control, and that true meditation is not a practice of control or concentration. Instead, he emphasized on the importance of observing the mind without any judgment or interference.
So we're asking, what is meditation? And why should one meditate? Is it natural? Natural, you understand? Like breathing. like seeing, like hearing? Is it natural? And why have we made it so unnatural? Taking postures, following systems, Buddhist meditation, Tibetan meditation, Christian meditation, you understand? The Tantra meditations, you don't know those, perhaps some of you may know. And the meditation set by your favorite guru, right? We are asking, aren't all those really abnormal? Right? Are you following? Why should I take a certain position to meditate? Why should I practice, practice, practice to arrive where? You understand my question? To follow a system, 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the afternoon, 20 minutes in the evening, to have a quiet mind. Having achieved a little quiet mind, I can go off and do other mischief all day long. These are actual facts I'm telling you. Now, is there a way of meditating which is none of these things? You understand my question? Till now, we say meditation is to quieten the mind, first. To have a mind that is capable of observation. To have a mind that is completely centered, right? Completely concentrated, right? So that there is no thought but except one thought, right? One picture, one image, one center upon which you are looking, right? I don't know if you've gone through all this. The speaker has played with them for half an hour in each of these meditations, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, and that meant nothing. So you have to go into this question. Who is the controller and the controlled? You understand? Are getting tired? Our whole life, if you observe, is this, controlling and not controlling, right? I must control my emotions. I must control my thinking. I can only control my thinking by constant practice. And to practice, I must have a system. This system implies a mechanical process, making the mind mechanical, more and more. And it's already mechanical now, but we want to make it much more. So that it gradually becomes more and more dull. We go through all this, right? Why? If you are meditating according to TM, right? Or according to somebody else, why? Because you want to have an experience either through drugs, and you know drugs do you harm, therefore you know you put that aside, but by practicing something you will experience something else, right? I don't know if you have ever gone to the question of experience. Why human beings are demanding experience? either the mind is asleep, therefore experience means a challenge, right? Or the mind is awake and therefore doesn't need an experience. I don't know if you're following this. So one has to find out if your mind is asleep and therefore, or bored with the experience that you have, sex, drugs, all the rest of other experiences, you want something far beyond all that. You're always craving for experience. More delightful, more extravagant, the more communicable and all the rest of it. Why does the mind demand experience? Ask yourself, please. There is only one thing, a mind that is very clear, is free from all entanglements of attachment and so on. Such a mind is a light to itself, right? Therefore it doesn't want any experience. There is nothing to experience. You cannot experience enlightenment. That sounds the idea of experience, that is such a stupid thing to say, I've achieved enlightenment. I mean, it's really dishonest. You cannot experience truth. Right? Because there must be an experiencer to experience. Right? If there is no experiencer, there is no experience at all. I wonder if you see that. But we are attached to our experiencer. Therefore, we're always asking more and more and more. So meditation generally, as is accepted now, is the practice of a system, breathing properly, sitting in the right position, lotus position or whatever position you take, wanting or craving for greater experience or the ultimate experience, right? This is what we are doing. And therefore all that is a constant struggle, right? Never-ending struggle. This never-ending struggle is hoping to end all struggles. You understand? Look what I have done. I am struggling, struggling, struggling to end struggling, which is sometime in the future. Right? See what I've done, what tricks I've played on myself. I've caught in time, right? I don't say, why should I struggle at all? If I can end the struggle, that is enlightenment. You understand? To have no shadow of conflict.
Neuroscientists have been studying the benefits of meditation and mindfulness on human brain for years. Dr. Fadel Zaidan of Social Cognitive Effective Neuroscience at the University of California applies scientific methods to prove how mindfulness and meditation can directly improve the human health.
We have some overwhelming evidence demonstrating that mindfulness and compassion-based meditation can directly improve stress, anxiety, and loneliness even after just 20 minutes of practice. Just 20 minutes of meditation practice can significantly reduce perceived stress, tension, depression, confusion, make you less tired, as well as improve your total mood. One 20-minute meditation practice can, on average, reduce anxiety, state anxiety, by 22%. This is a study we published in 2014 where we recruited 14 subjects, and after just one 20-minute practice, you could see the change. This is the percent change in state anxiety. You could see the change in state anxiety. So you don't need to be a monk to reap the benefits of these practices. And we also scanned these people's brains with a technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging. This is where we could take a snapshot of individuals' brain activation and deactivation. And these are the first images of a meditating brain, and we were the first to show how meditation reduces anxiety. So when someone is stressed out and or anxious, there's an inability of a part of the brain that controls thoughts and emotions to work. So brain regions in the front, the prefrontal cortex over here and the anterior cingulate cortex, they're deactivated. And generally speaking, they're deactivated because they reflect an inability to govern or control thoughts, worries, anxieties. Another brain region that's highly activated during anxiety and stress is this brain region called the posterior cingulate cortex. And this is a brain region associated with mind wandering, self-referential thought processes, the thoughts in our heads. What we found was just after very brief meditation training, meditation significantly reduced anxiety. And that anxiety relief was associated with greater activation in these exact brain regions, higher activation in the anterior cingulate cortex and the prefrontal cortex predicted reductions in anxiety, and greater deactivation of this region, the posterior cingulate cortex, also predicted reductions in anxiety. So we have, and there's lots more evidence out there showing that meditation works in this way, even if you're not an expert in the techniques. The amygdala is a super old brain region that's associated with processing fear, negative emotions, and emotions in general. And the greater the connectivity between the anterior cingulate cortex and the amygdala, the greater the stress. And this group led by David Creswell at Carnegie Mellon found some findings that are synonymous with what we found as well, in that mindfulness meditation reduces stress by decoupling this connectivity, that the emotional centers of the brain start to reduce their activation. They become less hyperactive, and that's generally controlled by these more prefrontal brain regions. Kind of, we call them the CEO of the brain. And this was directly facilitated by mindfulness meditation practice when compared even to relaxation techniques. Further, the same group just published some work last year that found that mindfulness meditation, as well as compassion-based practices, can significantly reduce the feelings of loneliness, even though they're not around people, even though they're not participating in group settings. The practice itself helps lower feelings of loneliness and increases feelings in social connectedness. So what we're finding out now more than ever is that simply self-regulating your feelings by just sitting for a few minutes a day can dramatically improve the way that you feel.
Thank you. talking to my soul. I see you. To my soul.
As Osho says, to be creative means to be in love with life. You can be creative only if you love life enough that you want to enhance its beauty, you want to bring a little more music to it, a little more poetry to it, a little more dance to it. And meditation opens and widens the path and road to this journey. I'm Katerina Badzaiki. Join us next week in another of our infinite curious programs of Earth and the Voice of Greece. In the meantime, try to close your eyes for 20 minutes at least once a day. Breathe in from the nose, breathe out from the mouth, and allow your thoughts to come and go as they please, but always gently bring your mind back to the rhythm of your breath. Slowly, you will become more aware of your presence and more appreciative of life, people, and things around you that really matter.
People are suffering. I'm with you. And the sky is clear. Only birds are flying. I want you, feeling your breath. How much I want you, hugging my heart. How much I want you, just to feel. How much I want you.